about the tales of the internet. Of the Tales of the Unexpected Tales podcast.
And we're back, and you said in the first episode that we did of this that in the olden days when we'd start off the Toto podcast, is that we'd be in the middle of a conversation. Well, we're doing this podcast, so that's the middle of the conversation. What more could you ask?
Exactly. It couldn't get more natural than this.
That's right. You're right in the construction site. So should we do a bit of a reminder? Because I don't know how I'll release these. We've got on a train with Peter Cushing and a bunch of other people. And Cushing said, I can read some futures if you want. Or I've got some Kit Kats. Polos, anybody want anything? And they go, we're interested in the tarot cards, man. So they go round and they find out their destinies. And that if you're not happy with your destiny, you can see what your alternative is. And the alternative so far has been death. And what we've had vampires, plants, voodoo.
No, we haven't had vampires yet. We've had werewolves.
Oh, that's what that's what I meant. We've had werewolves.
He did live in a coffin like it, so maybe he was identifying as a vampire, we're not sure.
And still, I love the fact that it was packed with like Amazon package paper. Really, really good. You just watch that back, it's so great. This episode, then, we've got our last two stories and what is described in Wikipedia as the epilogue, which ties the whole thing together. So we've got some questions about that already from when we started this. So if you haven't listened to the first two, you're probably going to want to, because there is a...
Please do.
Yeah. Yes. Right. So now, I can't remember, with it being Dracula's turn, so far, Christopher Lee's been a right idiot. No, he's just been really unforgiving and just, I'm not interested in this. And he's been writing off the fact that this tarot actually works.
I think Peter Cushing tries to use this as a way to prove to him that, you know, he's genuine by telling him stuff about himself and then predicting the future. And Christopher Lee just relents in the end and says, oh, go on then, you know,
right. So
get this over with kind of thing.
And you'd have put money on Christopher Lee going last with his story. Absolutely. Yeah. But it's not. He's the next one. And I think that's probably wise, because you're actually going, oh, I was not expecting that. And that... Mm. Oh, that's not the twist, by the way, that Christopher Lee was the second to last story. But this was... You'd have put money on it. It'd have been the big call. I like that Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee... sort of enemies again. It's just great. Anyway, right. So this next one then is another story that... Remember when I did Fly Paper, and I explained that was the reason I wanted to do the Toto podcast in the first place was because I took these little segments of what happened in the show and they stuck with me. Flypaper never left me. Like, Flypaper is the one that still scares me. And it's because it's real people. And actually, this is the one kind of supernatural thing that scared me, is that a hand could just crawl after you.
Take on the life of its own.
It seems like a weird thing. And when we get to some of the things that happen in this film, in this bit, it's ridiculous. But it did scare me, really super did scare me. So who is Dracula? Who is Christopher Lee? What's his thing?
I can't remember his name, but he's an art critic.
Let's have a look. I've got the internet page up here. It's something Francis, isn't it? Franklin. Franklin Marsh, his name is. And
Let's just call him Christopher Lee.
I've got here, when I'm looking at the cast list, it says Christopher Lee, Franklin Marsh, Michael Goff, Eric Landor. And then Isla Blair, pretty girl. I think I know who the pretty girl might be.
I wasn't sure because there was a couple in this. Is the barmaid listed as a character as well?
No. There's a nurse called Judy Cornwell.
Okay.
Hedger Wallace is the surgeon, but Isla Blair is the pretty. If you're wondering pretty who the girl. Pretty girl okay. was, this is great. So he's an art critic, and the thing is, this is based on what the comic book version of an art critic would be. He stands at a thing, arms crossed, and goes, "This is all fucking shit," and yeah. just sort of criticized. It's shit. It looks rubbish. He did it in about 5 minutes.
He has a real problem with this character Landor, yeah. or his art anyway.
Because that's the thing is actually the good point, Damo. He goes psychopath on his paintings, but it seems like he's got it in for the artist. Like it wouldn't matter what the artist did. He's got it in for him. We don't know what the backstory is to that. I mean, maybe that's in Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, the prequel. That would be good, actually. Anyways, but he's basically an arsehole, and if this is his job, have you ever seen Ratatouille?
Yes.
You know the food critic?
The food critic. That's similar, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. He didn't do the voice for that, did he?
Hang on a minute.
I don't know. I did.
Ratatouille film. Oh, no. I tell you who it was, though. It was another royalty. Peter O'Toole.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So from
that. It is a very similar character. Definitely.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, right. Okay. Well, I like that.
And he carries that. He carries that attitude across, not just in his work, but the way he's looking down his nose at the other guys on the train.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So this is it's quite a comic book reference, but it's one that we knows. I've just put here, is this what art critics did? Because I think there'd have been a period of time where we'd have all thought that. Since, you know, Sky Arts do their Portrait Artist of the Year and stuff, and we get a better idea of what an art critic is. But it is still down the nose. But I guess they believe they've earned that. Maybe that's just the type of person they are.
And I suppose the memorable ones are the ones that slate people. You know,
absolutely.
The Simon Cowells, if you get me, rather than the nice
people that are
singing
your
praises, you know.
So, all right, he's criticised a couple of paintings. He's again not happy with anything he's done, and then the actual artist Landor sort of is there. He's going, I don't understand why this. You'd be thinking this, but he's not as upset as you think he might be.
No, and I have to say straight from the bat, Michael Goff, the actor, he just looks a bit frightening himself.
I think so.
He does, especially when he's smiling or laughing.
Yeah.
He's got loads of stage makeup on.
Yeah.
He's just something about him here. I think it's because I'm used to him being an older man when he was the butler in the Batman films.
Oh, of course.
Of
course he was. I was just trying to think I get his face. I'll have seen him in something, but I didn't realise it would have been...
I think that's what it was.
Alfred.
Yeah. And he was actually in the first Dracula with Christopher Lee as well. So maybe that's why he has a problem with him.
Was he Jonathan Harker then?
No, he was one of the other...
Was one of the others?
Suitors.
Yes. I remember their names, I remember the pretty girls' names. Actually, Mina Harker, Lucy Vestenra. Anyway, let's go. So now the pretty girl comes over and she says, I think this is pretty girl. I thought she was pretty.
Right,
Why not have a look at one of our other paintings that we're going to demo? Have a look at it. And he gets it. And Franklin Marsh, Christopher Lee, Dracula says, "Ah, now then. This is what I'm talking about. You can see the band of colour, the the political scene. This that I don't know words that they use, but it's everything was textbook." And he goes, "He's brilliant." And he goes, "Oh well, actually, he's here. He's here now. Would you like to meet him?" And I mean, you'll just see this, Kimmy. You think it's like a 5-year-old kid or a monkey or a cat. It is a monkey. Or it's somebody with no arms and just his feet or something like that. That's what you're expecting. And of course, everybody's like, ha, ha, ha. And I think the thing is, that joke doesn't quite work anymore because we know that chimps do paint.
Yeah, yeah.
And they probably are worth quite a bit because of that. So they might need I don't think anything could be unartistic.
This would have been considered ridiculous
at the time. Yeah,
Daphne. Yeah.
Well,
even more ridiculous is the fact that they had a monkey, a chimp, in the office, ready to do this picture. Unless he was really a contracted artist.
Yeah,
and this was the start of animal art.
And because Dracula likes it so much. And it is a chimp that did it. Mm. Everybody's like, obviously, just going, "Aha! You're not as good as you think you are."
Yeah,
you're laughing stock. Next, we cut to a dinner, what do you call
this? Sort of reception. Yeah.
And is accepting. Is it an award he's accepting?
I don't know if he's accepting an award or he's just been... he's a guest speaker, but he's...
Yes, you guest know, speaker, yeah. Well, in the background there, Landor is in at one of the tables and he's busy doing summer. And then he holds up like a paper chain.
A Christmas decoration of chimpanzees.
But he's just holding it up. And the thing is, instead of Christopher Lee going... like ignoring it and just looking the other way. He stumbles over it.
He's totally put off by it, yeah.
it's an odd bit because I think now you could come up with loads of places where, and probably more montages of where Landor is. They might have done that actually for the sake of these 20-minute bits.
They cut it down, yeah.
Yeah, so loads of different instances where Landor pops up with a monkey, or monkey mask, or swinging from the trees as he's walking down the park. I saw it. Anyway, where do we go next? And after this,
he has another quick one where he's in an art gallery, talking away about his expertise, and Landor just appears in the background, and again he's totally put off and just cancels the whole talk. He just goes, "Sorry, I have a more pressing engagement," and heads off. But one of the people that were standing there listening to him talk just goes, "Oh, he's brilliant. He's brilliant." She's perfectly happy with the fact that he's just totally cut off talking here and headed off. That's what art critics have to do.
I love that. And then, so was that the final kind of montage of the chaos?
That's enough to make Christopher Lee go off the edge, all right, yeah.
So he sat in his car and he sort of waits for him at the gallery.
Mm.
I need to know what the intention is here. I can only assume. Well, what happens is he kind of hits him with his car, right?
I think he meant to kill him. I think he definitely meant
that
to kill
him. It's not just to maim him or injure. It certainly wasn't. He weren't trying to lob one of his hands off.
Yeah. What he does looks kind of logistically impossible to me because we see Landor go over the bonnet, but then he's at the side of the car and his hand gets hit by the front wheel. So that's pretty precise. I don't know if Eva Knievel could pull that off.
And if there was some sort of like rotary saw on the edge of the... like maybe that would have accounted for it.
Do you remember when Brian Harvey managed to run himself over with a car he was driving? Yeah. It's a bit like that.
He was trying to
work out how did he do it.
Well, he was trying to pick up a baked potato or something. Yeah. He leant out of the car and his head got caught under the wheel. It's the craziest story. I love that story. We have spoke about that. I don't want anybody to tell me how it was done because the joy that I go through trying to imagine it is enough, really. Anyway.
Maybe it was Tony Mortimer trying to kill off Brian Harvey to be the star of E17. But his hand is wrecked.
So we see The you got the unsympathetic surgeon in this.
Oh my god! Yeah. Goes, there's a couple of really harsh diagnoses in this episode, actually.
Because he goes,
but, yeah,
who is this guy? And then somebody says, "Oh, it's an artist." And the surgeon goes, "Not anymore." And because as you look over, he's got like his hand missing,
it's but a stump, yeah.
But his left hand still exists. And so he could still be an artist if he wanted.
We're assuming that he was right-handed, but
he could still do
like
it.
How bad was it? How bad would your hand have to be that they'd have to amputate it? I mean, fair enough, you can't use it anymore.
Yeah,
would they have to amputate it?
And the hand. They've definitely picked the wrong thing to lob off and the wrong way to lob it off, I reckon. The car.
I thought you were going to say, I didn't check this, but I thought you were going to say the hand that then appears haunting Christopher Lee was the one that was still intact, the left hand.
Imagine just scraping him along the floor. You very rarely see the end of it, do you? It's like, anyway, so, right. Well, Dracula's heard this on the news. Because it's like, oh, remember that accident last week? Well, Landor is still unconscious, and he's had to have an arm, his hand chopped off. Actually, yeah. I don't even know if that's the case. So he looks a bit shocked because I think he was expecting a death.
Yes.
Yeah. So that goes back to my question earlier. That was obviously the intention. Well, he can't concentrate at work. I need to ask you something else here then. So he can't concentrate at work and somebody comes in and says, do you want to come out for a drink? And he goes, no, I've got to get this done. He goes out the room and then he looks in his drawer. What is he looking at?
Christopher Lee, yeah. Was he contemplating finishing him off? Getting
with a gun?
Getting something to go and finish him off, yeah.
Oh,
I don't know. Because the next scene saves him the trouble. Basically, doesn't it? Because it's Landor out of hospital and deciding, there's no point going on here.
Yeah, he looks at what he can't do. He has not seen one positive of this situation. So he turns a gun on himself, which is interesting because you don't realise that at first that's what's happening because it looks like his left hand is also sort of like cursed. So, and it shoots him by accident. Yeah. I didn't realize the first watch at least, I had to go, oh, hang on, has he chosen to do that? Or has the hand done that? Now, you've got one hand that's gone rogue, but it never mentions the other hand. So I can only presume it was a suicide, like an agreed suicide with all of his body parts. I call that the gunshot sequence, actually.
Yeah, and it's not often they went to the trouble of you actually seeing down the barrel of the gun.
That's right. Yeah, it was quite arty, wasn't it? Next bit, you've got a section of the show. It's a recurring section called Driving with Dracula. And because there's quite a few moments where he does this. He's in the car. And then, now, it doesn't tell you how the hand got there, but it's inside the car.
No. Yeah.
So it's done some travelling. It sort of appears over his seat.
It's just over his shoulder, yeah.
And his hand attacks him.
And he is surprised, but not half as surprised as you would think somebody would be at something like that.
I mean, it's a good surprise.
Yeah, but I suppose we're just getting started here. He manages to overpower it and throw it out the window.
Because think about it. There's no leverage with, like, it's like holding up like a pair of glasses or a phone charger. Like it's grounded to nothing. So you can just, unless it was really heavy, you'd be able to, but then gravity would make it on the floor. So you've just got to go like that. And then that's what he does. And then he throws it out the window.
So so its main power, I mean, we see this to full effect later on. The hand's main power is going to be distraction rather than brute force. It's going to cause you to do your harm to yourself some other way rather than it doing it. I know it tries to choke him and that would probably work if he was, unconscious or something. But other than that, it's going to have to be pretty thrifty here, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly right. It's going, what's the most impactful thing here? Besides which, you don't want to leave like a strangulation marks on somebody's neck.
Yes.
If you can avoid it. Accident would be much better. Well, so
could have got the gun. But then logistically, how does it crawl with the gun? You'd have to sacrifice one, have the little finger dragging the gun along by the trigger.
Now, there is a film called, it was around the same sort of time, and it was something like...
This is the Five Fingers of Death or something, is it?
Something like that. And it was about a hand that was crawling through. Stephanie Beecham's in it. Right.
Okay.
Let me just see if I.
There's quite a few about this, you know, disembodied hands.
Yes.
I mean, there's the one out. There's the lad out of the Addams Family. I mean, he's pretty harmless, I guess. But you know,
the lad out of the
Addams Family.
So let's just go to Stephanie Beecham. I'll tell you. I was about to say it was recent. It's not. It was the one that I saw recently. Let's have a look. It would have been Dracula AD, Super Bitch. And now the screaming starts. That's what it is.
What a great name for a
film.
Yeah.
It's a 1973 British Gothic horror film directed by Roy Wood Baker, Peter Cushing, Herbert Lom, Patrick McGee, Stephanie Beecham, and Ian Ogilvie. It is one of the feature length. Right, so Amicus made this, right? And it is. The reason why it occurred to me is because when you see the hand crawling in our Christopher Lee story, you can see a seam down the side where they've obviously stitched the mechanics in. And it's actually pretty deep. For the amount of money that they could have spent on the werewolf story and didn't, it's actually a pretty good effect. But you can see that this is a fake prosthetic, right?
Look, it is a genius idea because the motorized hand, you know, it works.
And that definitely works. That definitely, it crawls. It knows how to do it. So,
yeah. It's like it's like a tarantula when it's crawling.
Yeah. I recognise this hand. Now, I don't think it's the same hand. What I mean is, I think it's the same technology. I think they've gone, we had a few of those for that film that we did a few years. Hang on, let me dig it out. And they've gone rifling around. Here it is. And it's because it looks the same. Give it a go. Yeah. You'll see what I mean.
But there is, like, the one I always remember. Do you remember the Michael Caine film about a hand? It's a horror film he did around 1980.
You only meant to blow the fingers off. The bloody fingers,
it's
sorry.
Harry Palmer.
I can't remember. Was there a hand in another Michael Caine film?
It was literally called The Hand. And this is one of these horror films that I've seen far too early in life because it scared the crap out of me.
That's what I'm saying about this. There's something about The Hand having a life of its own that is so bad.
Yeah. No, this one was frightening. And I think it was during a period where Michael Caine was doing a lot of dodgy films, you know, Jaws, The Revenge. And
oh, yes.
Stuff like that. But this one, Oliver Stone actually directed it. The Hand. It's one of his early films.
I'm going,
pretty gruesome in parts.
Michael Caine. Wait there. I'm just going to have a look. The Hand. I mean, I was about to say what's it about, but I've sort of guessed this. Now,
The only thing about it is it's his hand that gets cut off, but starts the hand.
Ah, right.
Or at least I think it starts to kill people that he doesn't like. You know, he's separated from his wife and she's with a new bloke, that sort of thing. And the hand is doing his bidding, basically. As most hands do, but this one's just not attached to his arm.
So this one was... Who was this directed by? Oliver Stone.
It's one of his early ones.
And he's also in it. And his character is called Bum. So I think
now, is that another part of the anatomy, like the hand, or is it a hobo?
There's two of them, bum cheek. Yeah, brilliant. Okay, this is why I love this. I love this because we go down other rabbit holes and it's difficult to stop. Right, okay. Where have we got to then? He got rid of the car from the hand from the car, yeah.
And he makes a home to his... he's also in a nice-looking bachelor pad by the looks of it.
Yeah, it's not bad at all. It's one you'd expect of an art critic. He seems to earn more than the artists themselves. Mm-hmm. But there's a knock on the door.
Yeah.
And he looks at eye level height.
Right? Yeah, never look. Which you'd never do. Well, you would do, but you would notice if something crawled in the door as well.
You would be seeing a hand, for sure.
Yeah.
Even if it was just in the peripheral, you'd go, is that a hand? Well, as he shuts the door, we see the hand kind of walking along.
But that is still, again, that's pretty clever, like the knocking on the door.
That is
something the hand can do.
It is. Imagine it. It's on its, because it's a stump. And it gets on its stump and then it does that.
And then kind of falls backwards and has to shuffle back onto its front like a turtle.
That's what I was thinking. A turtle, and then it gets some help and it comes in. Right. So, this one crawls and it gets as far as his shoe this time. He goes, ah! He picks... Now, there's some foreshadowing here because we've already seen the fire. So he picks up the hand, puts it on the fire and watches it sizzle. I've never burnt human flesh.
No.
But as I understand it, it gives off a really horrible smell. Like,
you can't imagine it's too nice.
So he's going to put up with that smell because...
What's the alternative?
He's going to get done by it. Well, he's now...
It is a good image. It is a good image seeing the hand burning on the fire, though. Yeah.
It's not squirming, though, as you...
No, it's like it knows this is going to do anything to me.
So, anyway, now I've got here his Dracula's writing at the...
Yeah, he's at his desk doing it.
Ah, yes, that's right.
Paperwork or whatever, yeah.
So he's at his Chesterfield sort of desk and the hand...
Yeah, he's doing his tax returns or something.
The hand is back. It's burnt, obviously. Which makes me think now maybe this wasn't the hand that was in that Stephanie Beecham film. Or maybe they just made a few.
The hand does look different a few times here. I mean, obviously if it was burnt it would look different, but it almost looks like a different hand every time.
Yeah, it could be different ones then that needed to do different jobs. What it does is it kind of crawls up the side of the desk like a spider would. And then
there's a brilliant bit when it is just crawling over the top of the desk. That's a real hand.
And the camera
just stops before you see the sleeve, the wrist, the arm of the person.
It's acting differently to the mechanical one that we've been watching.
Yeah.
But then we don't see it, and it kind of lunges at his throat. Ah!
Yeah.
And he gets his letter knife, you know, the envelope knife. Stab, stab, stab. And he locks it into a metal box that he just had. And he looks at the blood, which is the same blood that they used presumably in the werewolf one.
Yeah, the baked bean juice.
He takes it for a romantic walk by the river.
he's wrapped string around it just for added security.
This is the Houdini hand. So it's been handcuffed and it's got one of his straitjackets on and it's locked up with a padlock in brown paper and a string, and then he throws it in the river, and then
they should have got David Blaine to do the voice for this hand.
Shazam is the... so then he's in... I like this bit. There's a nice bit here because he's in a pub. He thinks all his troubles are over. So he's on the top of the world. So he offers to buy everybody a drink. The drinks are on me. He offers to buy the drinks of the people he's with. The drinks are on me.
He's with a couple. he's with a couple of who seem to be normal blokes, and it's almost strange that he has normal
mates.
Friends because he's such a fecker to everyone else.
So, but then there's a hand on his shoulder, and we go, oh, what's this? But it's just a hand belonging to a little fella. And the little fella goes, I heard that you were handing out free drinks. I didn't want to miss this moment. Yeah. I like that bit. it was...
Yeah, and Christopher Lee's so relieved that it's not the severed hand. He just says, oh, yeah, get whatever you want. And I was hoping the little man would go, bottle of Dom Perignon, please.
Yeah. Well, I like that little guy. He's not even credited on Wikipedia. Anyway, so he's now back in the car again, driving with Dracula. And again, just I like these moments where you go, it's raining, and then he passes a sign that has like wiggly lines, which I think means like kind of bends in the road or something. And so you think, oh, this. He's going to have to drive carefully in the rain. What you won't...
Is this straight after the pub or...?
This is... Well, could have been, yeah. So he's oiled up.
It's the 1960s.
And then somehow, because the hand has appeared and he spent all that time whilst he's in the pub, the hand has got out of the box and it's found the pub. And then it's waiting for its moment.
Yeah.
This is going to fucking blow my mind again.
Did it climb out up a tree, knew that it was going to have to pass under this particular spot? Or...
Yeah, I mean, because that's even more plausible than what happens next. It grabs hold of the window wipers.
Yeah.
And that seems to be enough to make him veer off the side of the road.
Yeah.
And
I think it's a combination of that and just, oh my God, it's back, you know.
It wasn't like the hand sort of shoving the car to a different direction or something. It was, that's the bit. Anyway, it makes him crash.
It's just distraction, a big distraction.
We see the results of the crash the following day where there's some sort of detective at the scene.
Yeah.
And... They're carting Christopher Lee away in his head's all bandaged up and stuff. And
yeah, just kind of two ambulance men, like they're like something out of Dad's Army. Or...
Yeah. And again, this is the least sympathetic people.
Oh my God.
Because he's still alive because he's like, oh.
Yeah. But
then they're like taking the piss out of him because he's blind and he's going to be blind. One of them goes,
oh, he'll live. And then Jeff says, yeah, but he'd be blind. And then there's this horrible scream from Christopher Lee.
So it's a nice gotcha because he's taken away somebody else's livelihood, and as an art critic, he can now only judge things that have been done in Braille, probably actually.
Yeah.
So he can't.
But that's assuming that an actual qualified doctor decides that he's blind, not just two ambulance blokes.
that's right, yeah.
But I imagine he has, like, big shards of glass sticking out of both eyeballs, so it's probably fairly obvious.
So, I was just checking. That really is where it ends, isn't it? It's, we go back to the train. Now, this might be the... Oh, I don't know, actually. Is this the bit where we find out that everybody's would have been deaf?
Yeah, it's definitely by now. It's not at the end, so definitely by now the death card has been revealed.
Yeah, so we've had four deaths as alternatives to the original story. Mm. So we're left with Donald Sutherland. And actually, Donald Sutherland is in a difficult position here because everybody's gone before him. If he'd said, no, I'm going to back out, it'd look the dick. But I think so. He's just going, you know what? I let's just do this. And it's like really light-hearted. I like him.
He's very cool, calm, and collected, isn't he?
That's right.
Yeah.
And so he, when Donald Sutherland says, I tap the thing. Oh, I've just remembered something from the Roy Castle one, when he does when he does the tap three times on the top, he intersperses his tap with a click. So he goes,
oh, yes.
Tap, click. Yeah. That, because that, if we didn't know he was into jazz and music, we know now, click.
Yeah.
Tap, click.
Actually, so much to that point that I wondered, was that the method? And the other two had done it before him. But you're right, it's just him, yeah.
Yeah, I did that as well. I thought, oh, I've missed the clicks. And when they did it the next time, it's like, oh, there is no clicks. That was just Roy being Roy. Yeah. In when we've got these new four cards that come up, then the Empress, mm-hmm. he says these out loud. The Empress, the Hermit, the Something, the Star, and the Lovers. So I know this story now, and I think I can work out the Empress and Lovers, but I don't know about the Hermit or the Star. Anyway, I could have got that wrong.
And there's not really an indication of, you know, bats or vampires or anything blood in sucking. This, or blood.
Anyway, well. So, right, this is a nice bit of exposition. He's carrying this lady over the threshold, singing, we've just got married, or whatever the... I can't remember the song. Is there a song?
I don't know, actually.
He gives her a kiss and then he plonks her down. And what we just establish here is that she's come from France. She's not been to this house before. So they've got married and come straight to the house like it's their first trip out or something.
It's a swanky new pad, and he says, I'll go and fix us something to eat.
That's right. So, yeah, he says, you have a look around the house while I battle with this baked bean tin. And then, what have I said to you? I can't see what my... It's kind of like really struggling. It's like the camera keeps cutting back to him, not knowing what to do to open this tin.
Well, he's got a screwdriver, which isn't a good start. A tin opener would have been ideal.
He's smashing it on the top, and camera he goes, ow, which sounds like the plant in the creeping vine. And he's kind of like shoves his finger in it. Look at me. Ow. I hurt my finger. And she kind of looks, this is interesting. So I think you don't need to now know. We've seen all these. These are all horror stories. And she wants to suck blood. What thing do we know that sucks blood? Vampires. So we know that she... she's not a bad one, because she obviously likes Donald Sutherland. She's not...
Yeah, she's like she's trying to lead a normal housewife lifestyle, but like an alcoholic when she gets a sight of a bottle of booze or a bit of blood, it all goes belly up.
She's a bit like them fellas in Twilight, you know, where they're in fact they live in the daylight too as well.
I haven't seen any of those, but I'm not surprised that they also break a lot of old rules.
And that's the thing, is we refer to this quite a lot in with the vampire law, where it's sort of, it's convenient law. We'll come to it, I'm sure. Well, it's late. Oh, yeah, so she sucks the blood. She's happy with it. And you mentioned something earlier about this scene where... He's like, what must he be thinking when he's like, I could put a plaster on. And she sort of thinks, no, I've got a better idea. And just sucking off the finger.
Yeah. And say it's possibly Donald Sutherland finds this erotic, but it's a bit weird.
Yeah, it's like, but if it could backfire, because this is now presumably the first time he's had blood on display that she's gone, oh, hang on a minute, I'll lick that up. And then it's a cut to, so that's happened, and it's cut to the night time. But she can't sleep because vampires are nocturnal. Now, here's that vampire lore. Even if we can forgive the kind of not having to stay out of the daylight, She still needs to sleep. Like, vampires still sleep. They're not awake all the time. Are they? Maybe the Twilight people, maybe they stay awake all the time.
No, I would have thought they'd have to... when they do sleep, don't That's one of their big things.
It's a huge thing. And coffins as well. I mean, they sleep in coffins.
Well, we've already had the coffin, but that was in the werewolf story. So it's there's only one budget for one coffin per film. Yeah,
maybe they ran out of Amazon packing paper to keep her in. Well, anyway, we see the open window and a bat. We can't. There's no amazing special effects here that transmogrifies her into the bat. It's like her then window bat.
Yeah, it is. As I said, there was a silhouette which just looked like one of those seaside seagull models.
You the one with the string that you pull down and it kind of flaps away for a bit.
And this one doesn't even flap.
Now, Dr. Blake, this must be the next morning then, I guess. Dr. Blake turns up and to pick... Dr. Blake. I mean, a guy called Dr. Blake. This is our first meeting. And he's... like the boss surgeon at the doctor's place where Donald Sutherland works, right?
Actually, can I just say, I took down that I noticed that he's actually played by an Irishman. Guy called Max Adrian, who I've not heard of. I don't think he's terribly famous over here.
Well,
at least
we like this.
Isn't these days, but...
Remember the old Toto thing is two first names? Can't be trusted.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Yeah. There you go.
That's interesting, that.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah. And oh, yeah. Now she scowls when she sees him.
Yeah. There is. There's an awkward moment between the two where it's like they're sizing each other up.
Yeah.
He's acting all friendly, but you can kind of tell by his face as well that something's up, and she's just... she's a bit creeped out by him, for want of a better phrase.
This stage. Yeah, this is the part of things where I'm just thinking to myself. Well, one of the options is it because, like, their exes, like he finished with her before.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But
it could be that. I never thought of that actually.
But at the moment, we know that definitely she's a vampire. So, anyway, they're later on in the office and they're discussing doctor things. They've got a boy in with his mother, and he's weak. He's got a
He's looking very pasty.
I don't know what they're asking her or whether she just volunteers the information. He sleeps with the window open. You know, it's. That's got to be a good thing.
I think the doctor, and again, this all kind of makes sense when you realise, you know, the story with the doctor. But I think he asks, oh, is he getting enough air? Does he? And she says, oh, yeah, he sleeps with his window open. So it's all
that was right.
Sense there. Yeah.
So it wasn't just apropos of nothing. Okay. So whilst he's kind of getting some sort of inspection, we can see two vampire puncture bites on the neck, right?
Yeah.
The classics. So that ties in with everything that we know. We've got to then roughly assume that it's the lass. It's that if it's his wife who's been who's got him. What was the line about? It's not that he's got bad blood.
Oh yeah. So this is how Donald Sutherland tried to explain the situation with the lad. He said, it's not that he has bad blood, it's just he doesn't seem to have enough of it. How do you know that?
It goes up to his legs, but...
holding the boy up to the light and saying, oh yeah, he's only about half full.
Well, Donald has no idea. He can't think of what this might be. Blakey suspects otherwise, though. He's thinking it's going to sound a bit weird, but my suspicion tells me vampires. Yeah. And I think they laugh at that point. I can't work out if he's being serious, but...
Well, Donald Sutherland definitely thinks he's joking and laughs, all right. But obviously, we know it's all part of a plan here.
When I
think about it, the Dr. Blakey here is probably going, you know... this wasn't me, basically.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
I know who I bite around here, and this lad isn't one of them.
Donald Sutherland's explaining this story to the wife, and she starts taking interest. First of all, he's having a laugh with her. He says, Blakey says vampire, isn't that crazy? and then he says, what we've done is we've had to take some of the kid's blood up for like an inspection. And she says, what? That blood's just down at the lab, is it? And he goes, no, we've got another lab further downtown where Dr. Blakey is sorting it out as well. So the idea being that, right, now I know where he is.
Yeah.
Because I initially thought this was where she thought there was like a supply of blood that she could just... what's that kind of like ethically just drink blood where you go, I'm not causing any death here.
Because like Blade. Blade was sourcing blood from somewhere, wasn't he? Without killing anyone.
There is that thing in kind of vampire books where you just think... they want to be nice. They want to be nice guys. But they still have to drink blood. So what we'll do is we'll get robbers and people off the streets, and we'll kill we'll kill people who deserve to be killed. But this girl, we know that this girl's gone after a kid, so she can't have many morals.
No, definitely not.
So we go to the lab in the hills, wherever it is. Blakey's closing up, and I love this how. It reminds me of Dario Argento movies where you get these close-up of feet, particularly women's feet, clip, and everything's dark and there's shadows. And he's closing up for the day. I guess there's nobody else in this building then.
No, it looks like the only light streaming out is from his room, his lab.
But it's got like at least three stories. It's like...
It's like he's in a block of apartments somewhere.
And I don't know if he can hear her shoes, but he knows he's being followed, and I think he must sort of think, right, it's that, you know, that vampire that I pissed off a bit ago. It's probably her. he's looking all pensive and stuff, and then as he's kind of like, so he goes down these stairs and she's following him. And he gets to the door, and I think what he does is he pretends to go out the door, shuts it, he leaves his bags to one side, and then he starts going the other way. And she must realise that, so she starts going back up the stairs. They're in this kind of weird Scooby-Doo-style chasing sequence. And then does she kind of like turn into a bat at that stage?
She turns into the bat, and comes towards him. Kind of goes into defense stance and makes the sign of the cross. It looks like it's not intentional, but as he tells Donald Sutherland the next day, it was.
He knew what he was doing, but he also knew, therefore, that he wouldn't... If he did the cross, then he'd be all right. Or, because he looked away, maybe the shadow didn't mean it was a real cross. Because he definitely looks away, so that probably was it, actually. And he goes, it's like she knew, but how could it have suspected that I knew? How could it know I suspected? That's what it says.
Yeah.
So Donald is musing over it. You've got a good point. It might be when I told my vampire wife that you think she's a vampire.
when I think about it as well, the way Donald Sutherland seems to come around to all this quite quickly. Is there a bit of the old vampire hypnotism going on from from Blakey here?
Oh, there could be. That's a good point, yeah. Yeah, to get what he wants, of course. Well, it's another night. Hang on a minute. Is this the... There's a chat with the mum again, isn't there?
Yeah, they have the mother and the boy back again. Still no improvement. And Dr. Blake says, is he going to be sleeping with his window open again tonight? Yes, he will. And he says, well, I'm going to be there too. And the mother's perfectly happy with the local GP spending the night in her son's bedroom.
But it should be okay because he's got a gun. And he's,
yes.
And the thing is, he's just sat there with the gun just pointing, with the window open. Then the strangest of plans, where the window's open, as he sees the bat gets closer. He kind of slams the door in the bat's face, so it kind of stuns it a bit, I guess. And then he shoots through the window. Why didn't he just shoot the bat as it was on its
as
way
it was
in?
Coming? Yeah.
Anyway,
and what did he tell the mother then? I mean, he's already presumably he didn't tell the mother, you know, I'm not a paedophile, I'm a vampire hunter. he told the mother he was just going to be obviously, you know, analysing the child's sleep or something. But then there's a broken window in the morning.
Yeah, that's true.
And blood on the window, possibly. I don't know.
Yeah, and because it could. Yeah, she turns back into human form, and she's bleeding from her hand. And I think maybe the bullet missed her, and she got some of the shards of glass. But it definitely didn't. It's not like proper hurt her. She's grazed. It's a bullet graze or something like that. So. She's got scraped on her hand. And then, but Blake is like, yeah, she's definitely a vampire. And that, I know what I'm talking about. And he explains this as he's whittling a steak into this lovely point at the end. But the two men in an office in their suits, and he hands over the steak to Sutherland and he says, what you want to do is, when she's asleep in bed, Don no point says she doesn't sleep. Like she's always awake or she's flying out of a window. It's never resting. But anyway.
She never does any cooking. We've just beans in the house.
and so much vampire lore is forgotten about with this because it's all out of convenience that it doesn't really matter about this because don't worry, it's this. Ah, rubbish. You've got to stick to your... And they had a vampire expert on the train. Two, how would vampires behave in this? Anyway, so now this is in their bedroom, right? She's not in bed and he's asleep and he must be faking sleep.
Yeah.
The window's open and you just see the bat come in through the window. And she just gets into, like, she must return to human form and then get straight into bed.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he's getting oddly amorous.
It looks like seems how you're awake kind of thing. Yeah. And puts the arm around her. And that's what she seems to think with a little smirk on her face.
Yeah, that's right. So he turns her over and he gets above her. And then... Yeah.
Is that a steak in your pocket or are you just happy to see me?
But you notice he got it out from under his pillow.
He did. Like, a steak under the duvet.
I wonder what else is under there. Peppercorn sauce. And then he, boom, straight into the heart. And then it's kind of like, I don't know if it's immediately next day. I sort of imagine it would be, but it's like she's there laying dead. She's dead. She didn't turn into dust or crumble up or anything like that.
No, she's just... she's just there as a human. And presumably I don't know. Did he call the cops?
That's a good point. Because he's there explaining the story. By the time we tune in, he's already told the story. And we've got Detective Kachansky, who I don't think he's called that. But he's kind of, well, I'm vampire. I never heard anything like it. He goes, ring Dr. Blake then. He'll tell you everything you need to know. All right, okay, I will then. In comes...
Well, he just appears. He just comes in the doorway straight away like he was there all along.
In comes Blakey.
Which he probably was.
He goes, vampire? There's no such thing. He goes, what? You told me to say this. You said this. He goes, nah, just take him away. Take him away. And then everybody walks out. And what they've done is they've basically left a crime scene unattended and a dead body just in the bed.
Yeah, and they offer Blakey a lift home as well.
Yeah, he says, "Now I'm all right. I'm going to enjoy the walk."
Yeah.
And then turns to the camera. Now, there's a line in The Lost Boys, at the end of The Lost Boys, where the grandpa says, "The one thing I could never stand about Santa Clara, too many goddamn vampires." And that's brilliant. This one came first, just not as punchy. This town isn't big enough for two doctors or two Dracula. No, or two vampires. Yeah. I actually put down here two Draculas. But I think what you'll find is that there probably is room for two doctors in a town. That's like, that would be a really useful profession to have wandering around.
Even if Donald Sutherland didn't have a vampire wife, was he still going to kill him? Because you're on my patch, pal.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, how does he think this is going to work?
Yeah, he's the only doctor in the world who says, "Yeah, less staff. We need less staff in this medical profession."
And then another strange, comical. I like these bits. These are the bits that I look forward to the most.
Yeah.
From a long shot, just slightly raised camera, looking down, the doctor puts his arms out in a cross. And then there's no kind of dissolved special effect or anything. It's just he was once a man and now he's a bat.
Yeah.
Just boom. And then he flies off.
Straight frame, just and floats up, really.
Floats up, yeah. Somebody must have been there, pulled the string on the seagull.
Somebody pulled the string.
And that's where that ends. And we're back on the train. And this is my final page of notes. You must be something similar.
Literally, this epilogue, as you call it, is it's pretty swift. It has to be said.
Yeah.
I mean, because
it's what you get is you get they've worked out that there are five of us on this bus. That's the slightly the less financially backed version, the bollocks bus, Dr. Bollocks is. Bullshit of bus. There are five of us with no future. And they go, "Well, what about you then?" But they're still not twigging that maybe he knows more than he's letting on. But then again, he did have a power nap, and that's everybody could do that. So they say, what he goes, "Well, do you want me to do this?" So I'll have a go. He taps three times on the cards, like he's told everybody else to do. Roy Castle didn't click this time.
No.
And then he reveals the sixth card. The fifth card, which is also death.
Yeah.
Now, that's an interesting one. Because that's his alternative. What we know later is that that's probably a bit more... not alternative, that's like the actual...
It's just a way of, for want of a better phrase, that's a way of life for him.
It is, yeah.
So I suppose he can just manipulate these cards, really.
Yeah, definitely.
It's
probably
the gist of it.
I think that this is a really good point of view that they all take. They go, well, it's not our stories that they're a problem. It's this train that's the problem. We're going to crash on this train. Really excellent surmising there. And then they say, I can't remember if they say
when
to him.
When he disappears.
That's right.
He disappears. Yeah,
that's
they
right.
Go through a tunnel or something.
Lights go
goes
off.
Dark. And when he
disappears.
Comes back, he's gone. Yeah.
Yeah. And then
so
previously.
They know that there's something supernatural going on because he's just disappeared out of thin air. But they still try and talk themselves around to... oh, well, we'll be okay.
And then the train starts slowing down, so they go, "Oh, we must be at Bradley then." And we've got off this train unscathed. So they must be in their head going, "Well, as long as I don't open that coffin with the werewolf in it," the other one goes, I don't want to be chopping that plant down. They've already got their kind of first stories addressed. But there's a problem when they get off because there's an oboe playing, and we know that oboes oboes don't, and I think there's a bit of a flute as well. They're not going to be good endings. And
absolutely nobody else there as well.
That's right. And there's a weird one because I didn't think, I was looking at the TV and I'm going, is that just because it's too dark and I'm trying to look around for the light? It doesn't feel like there's actually any distance in the background. It looks like we're in a small set. And there's lots of dry ice as well, which is so hugely important. And then maybe some of the voodoo paper that was floating around earlier, one of the papers comes in, the catch it really could. And
yeah,
the headline reads, well, what does it read? I can't see what it's
basically. Train crash, 5 dead, which is a low number, I would have thought, for a train crash.
Unless they were the only ones on.
Yeah.
And there's no sixth, so he's already off, and that might be explained because when they look over at Dr. Shriek, or Terror, he turns around and he's a skeleton.
He is. He's a Party City skeleton.
It's not like somebody dressed as a skeleton. It's one of them ones that you see in medical places that probably still are on like a kind of one of them coat hanger things where they're walking. Anyway, so they go. It's quite somber, actually, because that's it. The ends and the camera moves away.
They just realise we're too late. It's happened. We're already dead. And you could argue that was the case from the start of the film, because
that's it.
Was this rethinking the time they got on the train and met and died?
So they
as opposed to the train crash happened some stage during this film.
The epilogue in Wikipedia describes it. He is revealed to be death himself, which is why the fifth card was that. And it says then the men begin to slowly follow him into the darkness as the credits roll. And that's exactly what happens. So it's I just think it took us a while to get through this, but this is, like I said at the beginning, it's one of those things that stays with me, and I'll probably, over the last few weeks when I've watched a few of these, only manage to kind of organise them into the right films. But these little stories... This one, I think, has some really strong stories, and it's worthwhile doing them as a Tales of Unexpected special. So that's it.
It is, and it's a clever... The way it's all, as you say, spined together with them all being on the train, and ultimately the twist, if you like, was that, you know, they were dead all along, or it was inevitable. But I mean, it's a pretty harsh, the fact they haven't done any of those things that he predicted on the cards.
That's
where are they heading off to with him? Are they going to hell? Are they going to purgatory?
Should have gone to the barbers.
Yeah.
Now then. The film cost $105,000 to make, and here's some interesting. Oh right, okay, that is interesting. Here's some interesting salary news. Donald Sutherland was paid £1,000 for his performance, which is about $20,600 in today's money. Well.
Sounds about right, considering he was only starting out, doesn't it?
Yeah, which is good.
But it doesn't tell you what Christopher Lee or Peter Cushing are. Are they implying that he got the most money?
They've got to have done those two. And Roy Castle, a new album out of it. Oh, Kenny Lynch, you've got a new album.
Kenny Lynch has the songwriting credit, so he's all right.
Anyway, right. Okay, so plans now are, well, we're finished, so we're going to go. But we're going to come back season 6. As soon as we can, and this was just the tee up, just to get us back in the spirit.
As soon as we kind of publicise this, we'll have, I would imagine, a lot of our old listeners back.
But, oh yes,
it's worth noting that they missed us, they missed you, they missed Rob. Because I got a couple of personal DMs from people over the last year or so, asked me what's going on. So
yeah.
There's people out there that hopefully will enjoy this.
Oh, we definitely. You know what? We didn't want to. It was just difficult to. And we've worked out a little bit of a plan. So hopefully it works.
No, it's been a pleasure. And really looking forward to it.
Excellent, excellent. Okay, until season 6, we'll see you later. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. Bye-bye. The Tales of